Carl Tater. I'm Charles Hathaway. We've talked about genetics in the past, and it's kind of essential for understanding the way an ecosystem can become balanced. Because again, we are striving for creating an ecosystem that is designed to become an equilibrium. It's supposed to perpetuate itself and yet provide you a yield. And in order for that to be possible, we need to understand something about the genetics of the species that we have in our system, be it plants, be it animals. We need to understand some of that. So the basic concept of evolution is that species adapt to their surroundings based on pressures in the environment. Let's just say, for example, cold, okay? If we have an especially cold year and an entire plant species dies, well then that species doesn't carry on. It's simply wiped out from that area. If there is a survivor, however, let's just say there are 3,000, you know, of a particular flower in this field, okay, and we're just going to say this field is, I don't know, a mile or so square, whatever. And if we have a particularly cold winter and three of them survive, that is not many. And it's very unlikely that they will be able to pull through. But let's just say they do. Okay? Something about those three preserved them. All right? Now, it is possible that one of them, or all three of them, were particularly protected by their surroundings and so forth. Or it could be that they just happen to have an obscure gene that says, if it gets a little cold, do this, and you know, let's try to pull through. And they just barely pull through. Well, now all three of those that had that gene or that tendency to be in a place that would protect them, so that gene is carried on into the next generation. And while the plant, the flower itself, this particular plant, let's just say we're standing above this plant, looking down at this plant, this particular plant has one genetic code. It's a code that is full of information, packed with information. But not every gene that plant carries is going to be manifest in the plant. For example, say that it's a red flower, and three generations back it had a purple flower in its genetics, okay? That purple doesn't show itself in the flower, but if it is crossed with a purple flower, that may reinforce that purple gene so that maybe the next generation will have, you know, some red flowers and some purple flowers. And over time, it's very likely, if there is that purple gene in there and the purple flower with which it crossed was completely purple genetics, then it's likely that the purple will will sneeze. Will become more prominent. And I haven't studied to find out what the difference between a dominant and a recessive gene is. So there may be something of dominance of the purple or red gene, which will certainly make a difference. But the point is, if there is a purple gene in that red flower, it could show itself at some point in the future with another generation. But also, there may be three generations back or whatever, a flower that had crossed, it was possibly crossed with a wild version of the same kind of flower, or one that had been better adapted to the environment, and then it mixed with the this particular variety that it's known to be. This flower is known to be. Well, that one plant may have in its genes that little code that's been quieted because it hasn't had a cold season for several generations. It may have that code that says, if it gets cold, we can open this gene or turn this gene on. Okay, because it's there. It's a gene that is carried from generation to generation, and yet it may be off. It switched to the off position. Because think about it, if you have a blonde mother and a brown-haired father, then you have, and you have brown hair, then your blonde gene is switched off. It can be passed on to the next generation and flipped on, but it is there. And for you, it's off. Well, we tend to be aware of these visual and differences and so forth. But these differences are also active with other traits, such as ability to withstand cold, ability to withstand heat, the tendency to grow shorter when there is a lot of grazing that takes place, or to be longer when there is high competition for sunlight. All those little kinds of things can be on or off. And if a gene is, or if a plant is stressed in a way that suppresses its natural tendency, say its natural tendency is to prefer warm, okay, and to thrive in warm climates, and it experiences a particularly cold year, then that gene can be awakened. It can be turned on. If this particular plant just happens to have a great-great-grandparent that was a wild, cold-hardy version of that flower, that may switch on. And if it does, that is called epigenetics, that idea of genetics being flipped on and flipped off. Epigenetics are the genetics, or the information above, that's what epi means, above the genes, that is basically the switch. Should this one be on or should this one be off? And many of those genes are mutually exclusive, such as brown hair and blonde hair. Though you may occasionally have some that have, lighter brown hair. It's kind of a mix of the two, and so they're both on and so forth. That is possible also, but more often than not, there are some genes that are turned on and some that are turned off. And some of those genes, like I said, are mutually exclusive. You can, have this height or this height, and you can't really be both heights, but you may experience some measure of one and some measure of another. So the point is that if it is in the off position, and then environmental stresses provide a situation whereby that gene could be useful, it may be flipped on. Now, as a little side note to this, I suspect, and have every reason based on what I've learned about genetics, to suspect that this can be the case for abilities and interests as well in people. So let's just say you have an interest in playing the piano, and yet you sit down to the piano and nothing comes out. You know, like it just, you, you have sheet music in front of you and it just doesn't jive and all this stuff. Let's just say you have two grandparents that were musical in some way, and maybe each of them had a parent that was very musical, okay? Then you have genes for being able to learn music. It's there, but it's probably off because you've had maybe a couple of generations where there just wasn't much done with music. Nobody learned to do music and so forth. And this, you know, gene may be a combination of mathematical skills, of a good ear, of a good eye-hand coordination, all kinds of little things. But they're all genes that some aspect of them maybe hasn't had a reason to be manifest. And so the gene is off. And you sit down to play and it just doesn't go well. You try again, it just doesn't go well. You try again, it just doesn't go well. And you're trying for weeks and it's just not working. And you're like, I just don't have a knack for this. I'm just not musically inclined, is the way we usually word it. Well, that may be so for some. It's possible that there may be some people that just have no genetics for the kind of music that you're trying to do, be it playing the piano, be it, you know, singing, whatever. But I think that's unlikely. I mean, there's a lot of people in the world, and most of us like music to some degree, and so most of us have participated in it to some degree. And to the degree that your ancestors took interest in it in some way or worked on those skills, those genes are likely there, okay? But the problem is those genes may be switched off. Now, just like a flower being pressed to open that gene because it's a cold year, you provide the stress of trying to learn music, the brain is going to wrestle with it. The brain is going to fight it. And it's going to say, I don't get this. This is awful, you know, and it's not working. That stress may be what's necessary to open or turn on that gene. And if that gene turns on, it's going to be like a light bulb. And people talk about this, you know, I think that's one of the reasons we can all ride bikes, because there's something about our eye-hand coordination and our balance ability that maybe is a little bit switched off, and it may not, you know, we haven't had to exercise those muscles. We haven't had to have the gene turned on for that. And most likely the reason that we're not born riding bicycles is because that's just not a gene that is put to the test until we're old enough and tall enough to be able to ride a bike. And so if we have that gene inside us, that sounds funny, having a gene for riding bikes, but I can't think of any other way to put it. That's what's going on. You know, if your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents rode bikes, and then previous generations rode either horses or some other thing that required balance, then there is something there, okay? And at some point, when you're trying to ride a bike, it's just not working. You keep falling. And maybe you get to the point where you get, you know, the muscle reactions are a little better, and so you're not falling as quickly. You know, you make it 5 seconds and so forth. But all of a sudden, something clicks. It's like, whoa, oh, hey, I got it. I'm riding a bike. And sure, you still have accidents for a few days or something occasionally, but it becomes the exception rather than the rule. And I suspect that is the gene switching on. Oh, we have this stress. We have this situation that we're trying to wrestle with. I think we might have a gene for that. Flip. Boom. Whoa. I'm riding. And from then on, it's like they say, it's like riding a bike. That gene stays on. There's not any reason for it to turn off anymore. So that being the case, if you have enough generations where it's flipped on, at some point? And let me put it this way too. So you've got these three flowers that survive, okay? And you're standing over one of them, okay? And I say three because, you know, I don't know, maybe this is a plant that requires more than one. You know, it's not self-pollinating. I don't know. We'll just say there's three, and each of them have something or other of this type of characteristic. This plant that you're standing over has this great-great-whatever grandparent that was a wild version of the plant, and therefore has a gene that says, well, we can cope with cold if we get just a little bit of time enough to flip on this switch. Then what happens in the next generation? Two of these plants have some kind of gene that says, you know, with cold, we could flip this on, it might be helpful. We flip it on. They cross, that reinforces that gene. And in the next generation, it may be a little bit stronger because it's like having two brown hair parents. You're probably going to have brown hair kid. Two blonde hair kids, there may be some brown in their genetics, and therefore maybe they'll have brown hair, but they're more likely to be blonde hair. It's just more likely. So you get these two that survived, or these three that survived, they cross-pollinate, reinforcing that gene for cold hardiness. Now maybe these flowers have been in your field for 10 years, and this is the first year that has been this cold, okay? And so most of them die off, but three of them survive. What do you think that next generation is going to look like? They're going to be a little more cold hardy. And the generation after that, even more so. And if you have a particularly cold year, it'll kill off any that didn't quite carry those genetics and didn't quite open or turn on that gene. And what you get is an enforcement of the gene to be cold hardy. And that is exactly what has happened with the invasive weeds that we have brought from Europe or wherever. They're basically taking over the country. There are genes that we have not domesticated for because nature has done it really well. Nature's whole focus is survival, be that through hardiness or be that through effective reproduction, or be that through being able to avoid predators, avoid being eaten by whatever form. And if we are, you know, domesticating for the prettiest, biggest flower, for example, which we do, or the luscious, biggest fruit, which we are and we do, that's not taking into account survival as much. I mean, from the genetic standpoint, it is, because if there's a generation that has particularly small fruit that doesn't even taste very good, we don't pass on those genes because we don't want that fruit. And so we carry on the genes that were like, oh, this one's bigger, save these seeds. And so those genetics are reinforced. And yet, because of that, we are left to a situation where if you put those seeds, the biggest pumpkin with the, you know, tastiest fruit, which is great. If you can get that to work, great. But what happens when you plant it out in your field and you're trying to develop a system that has an equilibrium of survival and carrying on the next generation? Well, these pumpkins haven't been bred for cold hardiness or heat tolerance or anything like that. So the stress that gets on them, unless they've got a gene that can be turned on somewhere in their distant past, then they're going to say, but I'm bigger and I'm sweeter. And you say, well, that's great, but if you can't survive my cold season and you lose your fruit because of it, you know, your blossoms freeze and you lose your fruit, well, I'm sorry, but you can't make it in this system, because we're striving for a system that reproduces itself, that perpetuates itself. And that's not to say that having big, beautiful flowers is a problem or bad. It's fine. It's perfectly fine. But don't expect it to be as successful as something like an heirloom variety that has stood the test of time to some extent. Now, having said that, one of the points that needs to be made about genetics is that genetic diversity is really valuable. Because think about this. Let's say you've got this plant that has been tightly, carefully preserved generation after generation, inbred in order to maintain its purest form, much as we do with, you know, say a purebred greyhound dog, okay? It was probably, its parents were probably cousins, and their parents were probably cousins or siblings, or maybe even father and daughter, or whatever. And so you've got these genetics that are so tight that the genetic pool that person has to draw from is limited. It's been bottlenecked. Okay, every generation comes down, well, these guys are cousins. There's only so much to add to this next generation. And how many genetics do they have to choose from in terms of turning on and turning off genes? Well, not as many. Just that's all there is to it. All the genes that have been reinforced over time are pretty much all the genes that they have. You know, if you had some other kind of dog than a greyhound way back when, and chances are, just because you're trying to keep these greyhounds pure, they're all going to end up the same color, the same shape, approximately the same size. Obviously, there may be gender differences, but those genetic information on the gender differences are carried on as well. So even that, there's going to be very little difference for the most part. And what you get in the end is a very small genetic code. But on the flip side, if you have this dog that it's a cross between, you know, a greyhound and a blue heeler and a cocker spaniel and like 50 other different mixes, and all, and these mixes have mixed with other mixes, and maybe you even had a few generations that were stray for several generations, and you've just got this mutt, you know, then you've got this dog that has been adapting naturally for generations. They've been, and by naturally, I mean adapted for survival. You know, the greyhound that has been bottlenecked is being adapted for, don't change your genes. Keep it pure. Keep it exactly as the generation before. I want you to be exactly like your mom and dad. Exactly. And so that reinforces that, and those genes are passed on exactly like that, because that's the kind that survives. You know, if you have one that come out looking like a blue heeler, even though it was a purebred mix, you realize, wait a minute, there's somewhere in those genes back there that's not pure. We got to keep this pure, and you'll reinforce those genes by getting another purebred dog to breed with, and so forth. And basically, you're weeding out every gene that's not the perfect greyhound. And this is often, you have to be careful with heirloom even. Sometimes you get that. You get this, this bottlenecked genetic pool. And which, if this variety was developed in your location, for your location, basically it was like a weed in your location where you are. You know, maybe it was your neighbors that have been raising these, and they're almost like a weed. They're so effectively growing there without any help or water or any inputs and so forth, and you get an heirloom seed like that and put it in your yard, you can bet it's going to do awesome. But if it was developed in South Carolina and you're living in West Texas, well, I mean, you've got a plant that's very well developed for South Carolina, and it may do well in West Texas, or it may not. And if it doesn't do well, and you're trying to, oh, we got to maintain the purity of this heirloom species, you're going to continue to reinforce the weakness of that, of those genetics. Now, if you approach this wisely, and by wisely I mean, you know, from a nature gardening standpoint, where you want this to be able to thrive in your ecosystem and to be able to perpetuate itself, then what you'll do is you'll plant those seeds from South Carolina and let them cross with whatever the heck they want. Because when you do so, they will be crossing with the ones that survive. First off, the survivors win. And the survivors are always ones that are a little bit better genetically adapted to your climate. And then the next year, you let them mix and so forth how they want. Maybe you're saving a few seeds every year, but mostly you're letting them naturally perpetuate themselves so that they can reinforce the genes that work where you're at. Then over the course of 5-6 years, you're going to have a very robust plant that does really well in your area. Now, is it going to be an heirloom plant anymore? Well, really, technically, it's going to be a new heirloom plant, one that's adapted to your climate. But it may not be the same variety. It may look quite a bit different. Maybe it will be have bigger leaves, smaller leaves, bigger flowers, smaller, taller, you know, go to seed sooner, go to seed later. You know, whatever works better for your climate and situation. But allowing the plant to adapt naturally will reinforce the genes that say, I want to grow here in this location. There's enough of genetics that takes place and changes over time. And some of those genetic changes are through epigenetics. They're through, you know, this one says, oh, you know what? I had a generation way back when that did better in hot, smoldering sun. Let's turn on that gene so that we see if we can pull through this a little better. And then they will be more likely to survive, and they will be the ones to pass on their genes. The next batch of seeds that make it on their own are a little more heat tolerant because they've been reinforced. Those genes have been reinforced. So there is real value in letting your plants go from generation to generation. People have a tendency to pull up saplings, for example, that, you know, they call them suckers. Well, those suckers, unless they're branching out from the root, which actually there's value in that too, which we could talk about, maybe not this time, we'll see. But if they are seeds from the fallen fruits, those seeds that come up, there's going to be a lot of seeds that don't come up because they try to sprout and they're like too cold, too hot, too dry, whatever. Can't make it. Boom. And they're dead. But some of them that make it, it's because they have a gene in them that says, too dry? Well, turn on this gene. Turn on this one. Because when you look into genetics and epigenetics, when a fetus is in development, before it has the full shape of the plant or the person, the whatever, while they are in utero, if you will, those epigenetics are being flipped like crazy because you've just got this genetic code that says, okay, here's what we have to work with. Well, okay, we need cold tolerance because it's cold. Boom, flip that on, boom. You know, we need, do we have some big leaves because this, you know, whatever. And this information is being flip while in utero, and some of them aren't going to make it because they say, no, we have reinforcement of you know, being long and lanky, and as soon as it comes up, it's bit off by the first animal that walks by, dead. So it doesn't get to carry on its generation. And or you know, a worm gets it because it popped out too late in the season. Whatever. Anything that's an influence on that seed, if it survives, then already you know it has pretty good genetics to survive in this area. And if it came from seed, it's doing better than even its parent probably would have done. And its parent obviously did fine enough to be able to drop seeds. So you're only improving. Anyway, we could talk more about this another time. Oh, I should briefly mention, we could talk more detail about this. Anytime you have a fruit tree where suckers are coming from the roots, okay? Now, it's up to you whether to leave it there or to plant it somewhere else or to kill it, okay? But if it's popping up from the roots, let's just say it's a plum tree. Pretty much every fruit tree that you get from the store will be a graft or a cutting of some kind. Now, a cutting, now that I think about it, may come out the same as the parent. If it was cut and rooted, it may, the roots sprouting new plants will probably grow the same kind of tree. But if it was by a graft, and you can often tell this by looking at a tree, you could see a little nub at the end. It's got kind of this kink right toward the base, right close to the dirt. Sometimes it'll be a foot above, sometimes it will be just below the surface of the dirt. But you can see it's kind of got this little kink in it, or a bump or something. That's because what they've done is they had this root stock, they call it. It's just this generic plum. It's one that grew from seed, or it grew in an area, you know, basically it grew from seed, okay? And so they don't know what kind it is exactly, because it's not, you know, entirely true to seed. And so in order to be true to seed, so to speak, if they want Stanley plum, then what they do is they take a graft from a Stanley plum. You know, maybe that little rootstock is starting to grow. It's this unique plum tree, and it's growing. And what they do is they graft right toward the base of that rootstock a Stanley plum onto it, either by chip budding or by grafting a branch on, whatever. And if that branch takes and it does well, then they cut off everything above the graft on the rootstock. So what you've got is this plant that's growing a foreign branch on it, and that foreign branch is a Stanley plum. And so they cut off everything else. They kind of, you know, make sure that it's well established. That Stanley plum says, well, I get all the energy now, and boom, everything, it goes straight up, shoots straight up, and tries branching out. And we say, you know, just because stores do this, they say, nope, we want you to get tall and we want you to grow fast. And so they cut off all the side things, and it just shoots straight up because that's the only ones that gets to, so the only branches that get to survive. And you have, you know, all the energy of growth going into this straight up plant. So they shoot it straight up, and you've got this big, long, tall Stanley plant. Anytime anything tries to grow beneath the graft, they immediately cut that off. And they make sure that is not reinforced, because anything else there is a different kind of plum. It's from the rootstock. It's not from the Stanley plum. And so If you get suckers that are growing from the roots, that is the rootstock plant growing up, meaning that it's probably a different kind of plum, which means that you can either plant it somewhere else. You have to do that carefully when it comes from rootstock, because most of its roots are the main root, okay? Or you can leave it right there. But if you successfully transplant it, or you leave it there where it grows, yes, it will be right next to your Stanley plum, and maybe they will be squeezing each other for space eventually, which can be a healthy, you know, support / competition. But once that rootstock plum flowers, assuming that it's at a time of year that that is similar to the flowering of the Stanley plum, and they can be different, but assuming they're the same, then those two plums will cross-pollinate. And cross-pollination, almost always in fruit, does better than self-pollination. Almost always. And so you'll have more fruit on your Stanley plum. You'll also have fruit on your rootstock plum. And you'll have two different kinds of plum. Now, maybe they'll look the same, maybe they'll taste the same, in which case, well, you kind of lucked out. You got something from a stock that's pretty close to a Stanley plum. And if it's not, if it's completely different, then what you get is a new kind of plum that is a unique variety. And if you let that cross-pollinate with your Stanley plum and those seeds drop, then what you've got is a bigger genetic pool. There's a lot more genetics to work with. You know, whether your Stanley plum genetics were bottlenecked or not, whether your stock plum genetics are bottlenecked or not, they are now crossed. And so they have twice the genetic code to work with, which means if one of them, probably more likely the stock plum, has better cold tolerance or better heat tolerance or whatever, that's going to help the next generation to grow. And if you let, say, three generations go of trees, so that you have a fourth generation tree on your property, chances are ain't nobody gonna bring that plum down. That thing's gonna be able to survive anything and everything that's thrown its way, because it's well adapted to your climate. And what you get is generation after generation of continuing plums. So even if that mother tree dies, it don't matter, because its kid and its grandkid and great-grandkid are better, stronger, buffer than that mother tree ever was. Which reinforces what we're trying to do, which is have an ecosystem that has enough equilibrium to be able to perpetuate itself virtually indefinitely. So with that, and that goes for any kind of species, be it a lettuce, a tree, a whatever. And so that's what we're aiming for, in order to make sure that we can have that system that keeps going. The plums will taste a little different in that next generation, but if they're good enough, and yet you don't have to put in any work at all, other than maybe harvesting, isn't that worth it? Isn't that worth it? And what you'll have is a new kind of heirloom tree that is specifically adapted to your climate. Probably the dandelions in your yard, assuming that people have been fighting them for generations and yet they're going, are really an heirloom dandelion, because they've made themselves so. Essentially, you're trying to do with all of your plants, be it plums, apples, whatever, you want them to be like dandelions and growing as well as dandelions are. Because what happens with generation after generation, it's reinforced to the point where you probably won't have dandelions because there's just too much lettuce, and there's too much spinach, and there's too many apple trees, and there's too many plum trees, and there's too many of all these things that you really want for them to be able to really do well. You might get one or two in your yard, and the next generation just barely carries on, you know, so there's always a couple. But can you imagine that, having a yard where weeds just can't survive very long because there's too many other heirloom wonderful plants that you want? Now that takes work, that takes time, but you can do it. You can do it. And all it takes is encouraging them to do what nature wants them to do, which is survive and reproduce. If you let them do that, they're gonna do pretty dang good. So with that, I'm Charles Hathaway. Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Wild Tater.